From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the city of Buffalo, where a kid, a boy, then a young man, grew up to be a Buffalo Bills fan. He loved watching the players, the athletes, the high-flying offense led by Andre Reed and Jim Kelly and Thurman Thomas. And yet, there might have been times where he didn't feel fully welcome as a black kid, then a black man, in a city that, you know, had its own racial complexities, certainly plenty of racism. That young man has grown up to be one of the most visible leaders in Rochester and in Western New York. Sean Nelms is the superintendent of East, Upper, and Lower Schools in the Rochester City School District. He's been an in-demand speaker and consultant and mentor, focusing on a wide range of subjects: restorative practices, improving schools, vaccine outreach, and yes, anti-racism. And so as a native of Buffalo, Dr. Nelms had a unique perspective on the racist terror attack this past weekend. A white man drove from the southern tier all the way to Buffalo, intentionally choosing a predominantly black neighborhood with the intention of murdering black people. He would kill 10 people before the shooting ended. Many more were wounded. Somehow, Dr. Nelms always seems to have the kind of perspective that is vital and constructive, even on the most difficult issues. But on this one, there is no roadmap for this conversation. I just asked him if he would come in here and sit down and talk because, well, he's often the guy that makes everyone feel better. And I've been worried about Dr. Nelms as both a leader but as a friend and someone who's always optimistic, but I'm worried about what this does to communities like this. So I welcome Dr. Sean Nelms back to the program now. Again, I don't know where we're going to go this hour, but I hope it's somewhere productive here. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you likewise. You know, it's interesting. Usually when I'm on here, we're talking about topics that I've either researched or been a part of and kind of come in with some talking points and, you know, you kind of play it out. But this has been hard, and I have allowed myself to sit in my grief. You know, I told myself that I'm not going to force myself to work through it. I need to really feel it this time because I didn't have answers for my children. I didn't know how to give answers to school children. I didn't know how to give answers to my staff. I just, you know, I needed to allow myself to not have the answer on this one and to lead, you know, thoughtfully, but to also make sure that I go through those steps of grief.
So you grew up in Buffalo. I mean, yeah. The shooter wanted a neighborhood that was probably like the one that you grew up in, right?
Absolutely. I mean, he was very strategic. I got a chance to read, you know, parts of the manifesto, and he chose that. I mean, I know we've had in the past on this show, you've had Shane Wiegand and Justin Murphy talk about redlining. And Buffalo is even worse than Rochester. About 85% of its black residents live on the east side of Buffalo, and where Jefferson Avenue in Utica, where the Tops is, where it meets, was literally two blocks from my house. It's an area that we walk past. It's right next to the public library that we all accessed. It was near the Police Athletic League, where I learned how to box. I mean, so that community was intentionally targeted. And I think for the listeners, I need them to understand that that is the only supermarket in that part of town. You know, big brand supermarket. And so it was not only a place to address food scarcity and the issues around food deserts, but it was a meeting place. It was a meeting place for the elderly. That's why the vast majority of those who were murdered were over the age of 50, because it was the elderly folks going out doing what they normally do. It was a place to, you know, talk about local community gossip. It was a place to go, you know, be with loved ones. It was just it was a hub in the community where positivity and love was shared. And so that place and the type of hate that it endured is really significant.
Is this the kind of thing that changes you in any sort of permanent way? Well, I guess we don't know yet, but are you worried that this erodes some of your optimism?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound gloom and doom. Again, I am admittedly in my emotions and my feelings right now. So I want to say that. I'm sure at some point I'll develop some type of optimism around this. But I heard someone once say that, you know, hate is not the shark; it's the ocean. And this independent act just resurfaces the many examples of evil that has occurred within our community, or I would say to our community. And you look at countless acts, you know, of white supremacy destroying the lives of people to maintain power. And you can go from it's our origin here. You can go through the Trail of Tears with our indigenous folks. You can go through the entire period post, you know, slavery through Reconstruction to civil rights, to the issues that we see within the communities with policing. I mean, there's just countless examples of this type of evil resurfacing. And so I have no optimism that it's going to stop. This idea of white replacement theory, according to some research that we heard about this morning, over a third of Americans believe in some version of white replacement theory being a real thing. And so if we have large groups of individuals believing that there is a conspiracy to replace any group, it's not the people of color who are doing that. If there's anyone who should be upset, it should be us. If there's anyone who should be extremist, it should be us. You know, this continues to happen, but we continue to demonstrate that we are a loving and forgiving people. And my greatest fear is that there's a moment in which the people who have had to endure historically no longer start to endure it. And what happens to it? That's a powder keg in the making. And that's what I'm feeling. That's what the social media posts are. I've seen more people of color talk about, using their rights to have guns and the type of fear they have walking into common places and the skepticism. There's a new energy around this. There's also a different energy that's more concerning. You know, we're an hour away, and I'm in Rochester, and you would have thought this happened in a different part of the country. Like, the same visceral response in Buffalo is not even felt in Rochester. So is that a sign that we're normalizing this? I don't know. But I can tell you that on Monday morning, I was getting calls from work as if nothing happened an hour away, and my entire staff knows I'm from Buffalo. So I'm concerned about the response to hate. I'm concerned about the numbness that's starting to happen within this country around issues that target Black and brown folks. I'm concerned about the excuse making that happens from individuals. I mean, here we are watching an individual who went through a grocery store shooting Black people. He approaches a white store clerk and says, "I'm sorry," and then keeps shooting Black people, conscious. Yet we're debating his mental state, because people can't fathom that a white male could consciously kill Black people. Well, Evan, it's been happening for our entire country's existence. So at some point, we have to stop making excuses, and we have to just simply say, this is a part of our country, acknowledge that, and then decide what we do next. If we're going to be distracted by these baseless conversations about how and why and what to do next, then we'll never get to the root of the problem and then be able to eradicate it. I'm not optimistic that America wants to do that. And that's where I'm struggling.
So let's drill down into what you mean by America. 'Cause I mean, certainly I understand the big picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the overwhelming response has been pain and solidarity from the President of the United States in Buffalo,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, when he speaks to people who have lost loved ones, I mean, having lost his son, he does so with a lot of empathy. He's able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Your beloved Buffalo Bills, I think every one of them have been, mm-hmm. been out there.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about what used to be considered fringe. Mm-hmm. So when you say, I don't think America wants it, I think what I'm hearing you say is, this is mainstream enough that I don't think this country is going to treat this as a cancer, a fringe. I mean, it's on Fox News at night, and it's part of a mainstream party. And is that where you are?
Yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. There's no evidence that we take gun laws seriously. There's no evidence that we will call white extremists what it is. I mean, thankfully, the governor came out right away and called this a hate crime. And the rhetoric focused on that. But you think about that evolution, even in other parts, you know, Charlottesville, people reluctantly called it a hate crime. It was debated for weeks of whether or not it was a hate crime. And there were still groups in this country and political pundits who would refuse to call it a hate crime. And so, or domestic terrorism. I mean, this is what it is. And I think we have to be honest about that. And when I say America, I mean that. I mean, the vast majority of Americans have to take a stand against this. And the problem is it's so broad, we don't even know what this is anymore because it's showing up everywhere. We talk about it through redlining. That's why that community was there. We talk about it through equal employment opportunity. We talk about it through education initiatives. The depth of racism from a institutional standpoint is so deeply rooted in this country that we have to call it out every single time it surfaces just to be able to understand it, just to be able to understand it.
But the calling it out and the rooting it out seems to me that, you know, this was a guy who came from the Southern Tier.
Mm-hmm.
Come from a mostly white community.
Mm-hmm.
We're, as you've been saying, we're still a very segregated mm-hmm. society. And there's now entire movements that support this that are more mainstream. And so I don't mean support the shooting and killing, although some do. But thankfully, I think those who espouse replacement theory would say, well, I don't want to do what that guy did, mm-hmm. but I'm worried about replacement theory, which is not a thing. It's not a real thing. But when you talk about calling it out and rooting it out, it almost seems like if it doesn't come from within these growing communities,
mm-hmm.
that I don't know how it stops. Do you?
Well, so just like, you know, replacement theory is not a thing. Neither was critical race theory in the application in K-12 schools. And look how far that went. People knew it wasn't applicable in K-12 schools, but people still made it a talking point and people ran for school boards based on it to reverse it. I mean, it's incredibly concerning how much misinformation is consumed and then spread within our country. And let's talk about this young man. And I don't want to say this is a rural America issue because you happen to be in a rural area and all white community. I don't want to give the impression that's the, you know, the root cause of some of this hate. I think it's often spread where you don't have different perspectives present within communities, yes. But the day of the shooting, there were correction officers and police officers in Cheektowaga allegedly reposting an image of Top Supermarket with the words, clean up in aisle 4, clean up in aisle 7, clean up in aisle 9. These are individuals who are here to protect us and spreading this and laughing with laugh emojis. So if I'm an individual who's trying to work through the friction between law enforcement and communities, and I'm giving the law enforcement a second chance, and I'm saying, all right, these are great people here, right? And I knew some of the officers on the scene. They're great individuals. And then you see these laugh emojis and these memes out there. It's triggering, and you start to apply that to all law enforcement all over again. So every time we make a couple steps forward, there's an event that triggers you and kind of knocks you back. And I think that's by design, quite frankly. I think the greatest fear is for all people to come together around this topic. And so anytime there's significant progress, there seems to be an incident that causes this fragmentation. And then for those who have been on the fringe, they settle back into their comfort and say, well, maybe this is white replacement theory. Maybe this is an issue. And they totally ignore, you know, again, they focus on the shark and not the ocean. No, that's just one crazy kid who did that. And that's the shark, right? They forget about all the other things within the community that we've been fighting for. And the sad thing about this is, you know, none of these things are new to the black community. What we see with domestic terrorism is a way to mentally keep people in fear, people of color in fear. It's the same thing that happened with lynching. Lynching was bad from a physical aspect, but it was a mental aspect. My grandfather left the South because there was a threat in his life by the Klan that he would be lynched. That's why my family moved north. It was the fear that it would happen. Could it have happened? Yes. But it was a fear that you had to live every single day walking and watching your back. I heard someone say this morning that we feel like our blackness is just being hunted. And to live in that perpetual state of fear is very dangerous.
It is dangerous. And of course, I can't relate to what you're going through. Where were you when you heard the news?
I was actually on my way to the University of Rochester's graduation ceremony, and I was I had to present some awards that night.
Oh.
And so I'm on my phone, and I'm looking at it. And I said to a colleague, I said, this is just horrible. What's happening in Buffalo? And, you know, she said, what are you talking about? Because she hadn't seen it yet. She's not a social media person. My phone buzzes every 2 seconds, it seems. And so I got up there and I smiled and I shook hands and I immediately got off the phone and checked in with everyone that I knew, my family. So my phone's buzzing the entire time during the ceremony because family is checking in saying, we're safe, you know. And there was a moment when I'm sitting there and in this joyous occasion, celebrating those who earned this degree, celebrating those who have, you know, met the terminal, you know, degree of their profession, like I couldn't enjoy it. You know, because my heart and my head was back at home. And it consumed me Sunday, it consumed me Monday, it consumed me Tuesday, and it's consuming me now. And I have to allow myself, and I told my friends and colleagues too, like, allow yourself to grieve. Like, we can't keep pushing through these racist acts and then say it's okay and then go home and suffer alone in silence. And I think, honestly, Evan, that's where I'm at. I'm going to allow myself to suffer a little bit. And that doesn't mean it's going to destroy who I am. It doesn't mean I'm not going to be optimistic. But to push through these feelings yet again, and maybe it's because I'm from Buffalo, maybe it just touches a little bit different than others. But to pretend that I can show up to work authentically, I can show up at my kid's game authentically, knowing that everyone else in that audience is just happy and life moves on, and that thing that happened in Buffalo way down there is terrible, and pretend that doesn't bother me. It's an issue. I had someone call me today and said, you know, we have to, it was one of my white colleagues, and said, you know, we have to really, you know, we have to acknowledge that our black friends are hurting. And I just respectfully said, I can't wait for the day that my white friends are hurting in the same way. And that was, again, it was an innocent and harmless and thoughtful comment. But how I interpreted it was that this healing is a black person's issue. And I'm saying to them, it's an American issue. This is not a black person's issue in America. This is an American issue. And until Americans feel the same type of hurt and fear and angst that I feel, we'll never address this racist issue. And I don't know if that's too big of an ask, to be honest with you.
How are your kids at East? What's it been like with them?
Well, I think because it's in another city, and because, like I said, I don't think the environment
here. There's some separation, yeah.
Now, my own kids think about their grandparents.
Yeah.
My own kids think about their aunt. My own kids think about their cousins. But I think, again, I think it's concerning that our kids aren't responding. I mean, Rochester was named in the manifesto as a possible place for the same redlining reasons that permeates Buffalo. And so I think that made Rochester wake up a little bit, that it could have been us. But I think that response was more around it being so close. I don't think the response was, this was a targeted approach by an individual who represents a massive ideology in this community, in this country. We have to be honest. This was not some lone wolf who came up with this idea, and he acted alone. He shared the manifesto before he did the act. He had been writing about it for months, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this kid, he ain't a kid, forget that, this murderer, was in someone's school less than 2 years ago. And so he was someone who walked among us. And he was at the grocery store days prior. He arrived in Buffalo on Friday. So you can't convince me or the black community that this wasn't something that was bigger than just this one kid. this was something that was intentional. It was something that was planned, and it was something that we think it played out in this situation with a gun, but it's played out through policy in the past. It's played out through employment opportunities in the past. It's played out through us not being accepted in certain spaces in the past. And so we see and we feel the ocean. And I think often our allies and friends, they respond to the shark.
I'm not going to spout some platitudes that are designed to make anybody sort of feel better in a hard moment. I share your feeling that sometimes the appropriate response is just to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And not try. And there are so many ways that we, with modern society and technology, we can not grapple with emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm with you. Sometimes you just have to hurt and feel that and ask yourself what that means and allow that to sink in. But after I take a couple of phone calls, we will talk about there's two ways that this changes. And they are interrelated, but you know they're not exactly the same. And one is culture, and one is policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we'll talk a little bit more about that with Dr. Sean Nelms, who is a native of Buffalo, and grew up very close to where that mass shooting happened, a terrorist, racist attack. And but let me take a couple of phone calls. Let me start with Rich in Rochester. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Well, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Of course, I called in with one thought, but 10,000 other thoughts hit my mind as I listened to the conversation. To your guest's point, I have had my white friends give me condolences like the people who died were other. They didn't see it. They didn't see these people who died as them. Whereas when we have the mass shootings and the schools and all these other places where they're whites, it's a pain for the country. The country's in pain. Hmm. I feel no sense of pain out here outside of the black community. That's what's really bothering me. I have some of my more astute friends who notice it, but I don't hear the conversation. I don't hear the conversation. And the thing about it is, and I've been saying this for years, there's nothing more quintessential than all American than racism and slavery. Think about slavery almost curtailed the Constitution. It was the biggest sticking point in the Constitution was slavery. People say it's institutions. Institutions don't make decisions. People do. At every level in our country, for your average, everyday, even white person, if I move into a neighborhood and I move near a white person, guess what? Automatically, the value of their house drops for no other reason that I walked in that door that day. And to your guest point, that's why black people are the most pragmatic political people in this country, because we understand that we must vote for the lesser of two evils all the time. That's why we didn't have we pushed hard for Hillary Clinton to be voted in, because we knew about the Supreme Court, whereas many of my white friends wouldn't, because they were voting on principle. We don't have those luxuries. We understand we don't have those luxuries. I have not dealt with this. I won't deal with it. I won't deal with this pain. I read up a couple of minutes of this, and I just said, I can't. I mean, it's painful, because, like I said, it's not that it was black people that died. That was horrible, and that was. But what bothers me is the community in general is not taking this on. This is not Columbine to too many people.
Oh, boy. Rich, I appreciate the phone call, and I'll just turn it over to Dr. Nelms if you want to add anything there.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say it any better than that. you know, there's a quote that I often refer to by James Baldwin, and he says, to be black and conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage. And I think for any person of color in America who's conscious and understands the historical nature of this country, you become a little less optimistic when these things happen. It's a new cycle on repeat. And so I wonder at times, what does it mean to be white and conscious in America? You know, do you consciously ignore and just say forget about it, but understand that all the things that occurred has created the structures that we have today? Or do you consciously accept it as the status quo? Or do you consciously have the conversations and make decisions to change what's to come next? You know, I had someone yesterday called me. I have a lot of people who reached out, and I say this with the utmost like care and respect for people who have. I really appreciate it because it helped me kind of think and reset. But one person said, you know, we're thinking about doing some work to get information out about people of color so that we can, you know, help white people understand the contributions and et cetera. And I said, I don't mind that. I said, but if we center whiteness in that decision-making, that we're going to do something to make white people better understand and feel more comfortable, it still centers whiteness. I would much rather you spend the time centering domestic terrorism that's predominantly happened by white men at the center and have white people talk about that. And do it in a room where there are no people of color and have your own internal honest conversations about it and not have a black or brown DEI coordinator be the one to facilitate it. I think it's time for white people to have closed conversations and honest conversations about this country. And that's not an exclusionary process. And don't take me literal when I say that. But what I'm saying is I think when Uncle Joe or Uncle Donald has these conversations at the family cookout in front of your kids and you simply chuckle and laugh it off and you walk away, and then when your kid's in the car, you say, oh, that's just Uncle Joe, Uncle Donald being who they are, then you're complicit. So those are the moments where black folks aren't or brown folks aren't. And so those are so center white supremacy in those conversations with white folks and have an honest conversation about it. And that doesn't mean you have to give up anything. We're not asking people to give up your job or give up your raise or, you know, to give up money. We're saying we want you to give up the comfort that's afforded to you by your ability to be consciously ignorant.
Let me offer one observation, then we'll go back to some feedback here. When you talk about, you invoke Baldwin, when you talk about, you know, to be black in America is to be in a state of constant rage. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the feelings of anger and hurt and fear, those are real feelings based on a real history that actually exists. And when you use the phrase centering whiteness, there will be some listeners in the audience who think, well, that's woke speak, you know, that's whatever. But it is literally happening when in schools we obsess over, did that lesson make white kids feel bad? Now, I understand, like anything else, there are outlier and bad examples of things, bad lessons, bad teachers, people not doing it well, people being taking the wrong approach with kids. But as Justin Murphy said after he put his recent book out, like white kids should feel a certain way at times. And we should help them work through that. Mm-hmm. But like you talk about centering whiteness, this notion of, well, if we teach exactly the history that is just be real about the history, that it might make kids feel bad when there are black kids who already feel bad, that is centering whiteness, right?
I think you have to center American history. And that includes all people. And so And it's interesting. So that quote, it says about being a black man, but the word conscious is important to his quote, to be black and conscious. And when people say, oh, that's just woke speak, I question, why wouldn't you want to know? Like, what is wrong with knowledge? What is wrong with understanding? Again, it's the comfort of being able to be, it's the comfort of being consciously ignorant. I just made that up, right? But that to me, that's what it says. There's a comfort in me being able to ignore what I know is true.
That's really good, by the way, the comfort of being consciously ignorant. I mean, that's, sad but true.
That's what it is. And so I think being woke is a threat to that. And again, I've heard nobody of color in my circle say, we want white people to feel guilty. It's just we want to have an honest conversation, a conversation about the starting point so we can collectively decide the end point. And right now, white extremism and racism is dominating the airwaves, is dominating the discussion. And like I said earlier, you have a third of the people who believe in some type of white replacement theory.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That means the horse is already out of the stable.
It's a lot of work to undo that. And I think too often the focus for a long time has been on tolerance, the word tolerance, mm-hmm. right? Tolerance is not nearly good enough.
I don't need you to tolerate me because it censors you.
Absolutely. Tolerance, for whatever reason, when I was growing up, it was like, you know, racial tolerance mm-hmm. or, you know, tolerance. Tolerance is the wrong approach on every level. Mm-hmm. It implies that there's something painful or difficult or bad. But, you know, you could, like, if I'm playing baseball and I, like, stub my toe, I'm going to tolerate that to go up mm-hmm. there. That is not the same. Like, that's not what we're trying to do here.
We want consciousness. We want people to understand.
Celebration of each other.
Exactly.
Celebrating what is different as something to be loved. It's not tolerance.
When you travel, you see, I just got back from Barcelona a few weeks ago, and then there was this discussion with the Catalonian people and the Spaniards, and the way in which individuals there talk about the history is one of acknowledgement of the issues, but a progressive move forward. Like, it's everywhere you go, the taxi driver, the restaurant person, and the messaging when you travel, like, don't ask someone from Catalonia if they are Spanish. Like, don't even ask that question. Yeah. It's offensive. So, like, there is a consciousness about what happened, but also an acknowledgement that they're a better country if they move forward. That it's a better city if they move forward. You know, and that's, it was so beautiful to experience that, to be in a place where there was injustice and to see the growth forward. Unfortunately, I just don't. I do not want to give the impression that there has not been progress, because there has. As I said, you know, to think about how we talk about this terrorist as opposed to how we did in Charlottesville is progress. To see the media not mention his name or give him the opportunity to have his face shown was a conscious decision by the media. Say, we're not going to glorify this domestic terrorist. To have the governor and the mayor and the FBI and the police department stand up the day that it happened and to declare this domestic terrorism is a big thing. I mean, I think there's progress. My question becomes, will the progress only happen in Buffalo, or is it going to happen throughout this country?
Right, right.
And having progress as a proof point in certain cities around certain tragic events is not enough. I posted recently, I just want to breathe in America. I want to go to any of our 50 states and any city within and feel comfortable and not worry about having to make others around me feel comfortable. I don't want to live in a world where I have to prepare for the next triggering event. And more importantly, I don't want to live in a world where I have to prepare for my response to it. And nor do I want my kids. I mean, you and I today started talking about our kids and sports and coaching and the wonderful aspects of coaching. You see kids in their rawest form, so innocent, so understanding, so coachable. And if we start there, and that's why education is so important, that's why this push towards anti-critical race theory is stupid. It doesn't even exist. But to have in an education, in a legal setting, yes, but to have conversations around culturally relevant, responsive education, which we've been doing for years at East, is critically important because it gives a balanced perspective about America. Today we have an unveiling at East at 3:15, a big mural of the day before Malcolm X was assassinated, featuring him and Reverend Florence and Connie Mitchell, who was the first elected black county executive, a legislator. The mural was being unveiled today. And to me, it's just so symbolic. Today is Malcolm X's birthday. And to have this celebration of someone who demonstrated and spoke out against the same things that were talked to happen on Saturday. His rhetoric was about white extremism and about the black community having to come together to understand it and to be conscious about it so they can attack it thoughtfully. He said politically, economically, socially, whatever it takes, as long as it is intelligently designed to get results. Those are his words, right? His words still live on today. And he had extreme ideas over the course of his life. He spoke about a lot of things that were unpopular. But he went to Mecca and understood, once he went internationally, see how beautiful the world was, and that outside of this American context, the world is more unified. In the second half of his life, he was much more representative of where we should be in America. So yeah, I mean, yeah. So I guess this is not a very coordinated conversation, but it's an emotional one. So
you're moving a lot of people. Yeah. I'm just looking at the feedback. I'm not going to read everything. Can't read. If you've emailed, I'll try to get to some of them. We're going to take our only break, but I've got Dr. Sean Nelms with us in studio here, who I can't think of a more appropriate person to be talking about this issue. Sean's from Buffalo, from right near the area where that terrorist attack happened. He's not going to play the game of being Mr. Optimist today. This is the most, I think, important kind of conversation that we all need to hear, and we'll get some of your feedback on the other side. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Gino Finelli from City Magazine hosts the program. We're talking about the future of High Falls and development. And then in our second hour, Gino in his wheelhouse talking about the beer scene, the craft beer scene, where we are now in Rochester and the Finger Lakes, and what's changing. We'll talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. David in Canada says Sean's words have moved him to tears this hour, and he's deeply appreciative of that. I'm hanging in there myself, David. I'm trying to hold it together here, but I'm grateful to have Sean Nelms with us in studio, and let me get some of your feedback via the phone. Betsy in Brighton is next. Hi, Betsy. Go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to respond that I understand that black people would feel rage. Somebody who's white and aware, I think, feels despair. Because many of us don't, we despair for our neighbors in the city and of people of different ethnicities and religions, because this country was founded on diversity, or it should have been founded on diversity. And it's just very disheartening to hear the attitudes that are espoused from media outlets like Fox and stuff like that, and that people can be so tone deaf or susceptible to following its spell. It's very disheartening. And I think that one of the problems is the segregation that we've got in our society, and I see it within our own community, and the reluctance of my white suburban neighbors to go into the city because they're afraid, and I think afraid of what, you know, and even like their fear of foreigners, you know, a lot of them like to go on canned trips abroad where, you know, they're basically staying isolated within their own little travel pack, as opposed to actually integrating and getting to know people of different cultures and ethnicities. And I think that's what makes the world such a rich place. And I really wish that there were some kind of opportunity, and I would be happy to volunteer for it, to be in the city teaching kids or facilitating interaction between kids of different neighborhoods or ethnicities or religions, so that they could get to know one another, because I think that that's really where the problem originates. And I think back to after World War II, there was a program developed called the American Field Service that brought international students into the United States and vice versa, so that we could get to know one another's cultures and be less afraid of others. And I think that that was a really great program in its initiation. I think it's kind of lost some of its impact as the world has become more global, but I think that it would be valuable to have something like that on a microcosm basis within cities and suburban areas so that there would be less fear of others.
Well, let me just jump in here, Betsy. There's a lot there. I appreciate that. And it dovetails a bit with what Roger emailed, which is tolerance is not the cure to racism. Meaningful integration is. We are still too segregated. We can't understand each other if we don't know each other. So Roger and Betsy with a lot there. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think Roger is right. I think Betsy is right as well. I think, you know, authentically knowing one another becomes important. And it has to be, you know, engaging with people meaningfully. And I think just being in proximity, like, you know, there's a big push around, you know, countywide schools. And I said, you know, if we just put kids together, but they're living in the same space of discrimination and racism and sexism, then the kids are just going to be traumatized in those settings. So, you know, it's not physically putting people together, it's putting the people together meaningfully and in safe ways. And so I think that's important. And again, I want to say there's progress. You know, you look at the Jazz Fest, you know, you look at, you know, Fashion Week for the Center for Youth. There are, you know, very few, but there are opportunities for people to gather and to see one another, get to know one another, to make it. But this, it's not, it's too far and few in between. I mean, you know, so, you know, again, I think this is our work. This is our work. This is our work locally. It's our work nationally, you know, if we want to take it on. And honestly, I started this conversation a little less optimistic than I am now. And hearing their listeners lean in has helped.
Well, let me also just make one other point to Betsy. And I don't think Betsy intended this at all, but sometimes you hear really well-meaning people talk about, you know, programs, integration,
right,
bring cultures together, as if, you know, this assumption is, well, all the black people are always going to live in the city. We should have a society where there's true self-determination, and I mean true self-determination. If neighborhoods where people have grown up, they want to stay there, they want to stay there. That's great. They should be allowed to do that. But, you know, we should be sick of seeing suburbs blocking all forms of housing, the kinds of initiatives that might bring more socioeconomic diversity, diversity of different kinds. That stuff gets blocked still today under all kinds of excuses. So real self-determination, because we've created, the white people created the segregation. It is a product of intention. So I appreciate that, though, Betsy. In Maryland, David is calling. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm really into the points being made by Dr. Nelms and yourself. And I'm not a typical white. I'm married to an African, and my son just graduated with a degree in African American studies. But I do think a lot about the communications and how to get across the whites to really bring them on board with, let's just call it, Black Lives Matter. And I think if the messaging is just, here's what you white guys have done in the past with slavery and segregation and all of the things that you can bring up, I don't think that's going to play. It's not going to bring on people. Whereas, you know, going back actually to the Civil War and saying, you know, there were soldiers from the North, there were soldiers from Rochester, there were soldiers from many, many states here who went and died in the cause of equality and bringing African-Americans up to the level of citizenship in part and being citizens of the United States. So just when it comes to the messaging, I would make that mix. Don't ignore the segregation. Don't ignore the slavery. But, you know, bring on the fact that in the past there have been whites that fought and died, you know, for this cause, as well as, you know, many other instances. So that's my point.
Okay. Thank you, David. Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, but I don't think the starting point in terms of from a historical standpoint should be, context should be determined by how issues of race are being introduced. I think white people who have not been engaged in this work, or anyone who's been engaged in this work, they have to decide what their starting point is. If they are saying, I'm only going to start with 2022 moving forward and I want to ignore everything else, then it indicates the type of introspection they want to have about these topics. If someone says, I want to really understand how I got to this place, you know, why is my community homogenous? You know, why do I work in an organization where there are no leaders of color in management? You know, why do I attend my daughter's AAU volleyball tournament and there's only one team of kids of color and it happened to be from some large inner city in Baltimore? We have to be thoughtful about the world around us, and then you determine where your own starting point is. Some people may want to start the Civil Wars. Others may want to start a segregation. And I think that's been the problem. I think we've tried to be too prescriptive around how to address these topics when everyone's willingness to have the same starting point differs. And so it starts with people just looking around. Listen, my daughter played travel volleyball and basketball.
I was going to say the volleyball story sounded specific.
I would walk into these large arenas all over the country.
Yep.
And there would be like no black kids there. Or you would see the biracial kid on the team. Or you would see a team with a large number of black girls and they happen to be from Baltimore or from a large city that funded these kids to go out there. And that's sad. I mean, there are spaces that are almost entirely white, and white people see it and don't even question it. Don't even question it. Don't even say, like, this doesn't look or sound right. Like, why is this so homogenous? Why do we attend restaurants in Rochester and there's like no one of color in there? And I think people have to be honest about that and say, I notice it and I'm good with that.
Laura Ingraham on Fox this week said that Joe Biden's diverse cabinet is trying to turn America into a third world country. That's racism.
but not to those who believe in white replacement theory.
It's amazing.
It's a dog whistle.
Diana Louise says, my condolences to Dr. Nelms and all who are grieving. As a white woman, I'm not sure what to do about Buffalo other than join the grief. I am reading 400 Souls in a church-wide read at Asbury First United Methodist. In one chapter written by Christopher LeBron, it says, blacks do not need allies who fight for our inclusion. Rather, we need people who are possessed of the basic belief that we are human and that any arguments that depend on rejecting that proposition are tyrannical, unjust, and to be fought. I need guidance on how to fight. I'm already grieving how unjust our society is.
Yeah. You know, I think everyone's fight is going to be different. I mean, I know after I settled down a little bit, I'm going to go back to my job, which is an educator, and I have direct control over what our kids learn. And so in my workplace, I'm going to focus on the curriculum. I'm going to focus on providing opportunities for teachers who don't teach at East to have access to materials. And then if teachers, I'm going to pick on teachers in this case, if teachers really want to do this work and the resources are available and they don't lean in, then I know their starting point, where their starting point is. Their starting point is to not do it. Others are going to, those who will ask questions and superintendents who will reach out and administrators will reach out and say, hey, do you have any more of those materials? Then I know what their starting point is. And so I'm not going to fix that for people. And I think people who are sitting and waiting and wanting to study the problem even more and to have peace circles and to do book talks, like, you know, God bless you. But the work moves forward. And you have to decide your starting point. It doesn't have to be something so grand and earth-shattering that it takes you months to plan. You can leave your house today, go into your local grocery store, walk with your kids, and notice for yourself the newness of those communities of segregation. Replay conversations you've had at work about the Buffalo shooting. Are people using the us language around is happening in America, or are they using language about those folks or those poor black people? What language have you used in those conversations? So it doesn't take a lot for you to be reflective about what you said, done, and what you have not said, what you have not done. And then you have to make a decision how you want to lean in. And if your starting point is to not lean in, then get out the way.
Last minute, you said to call it out when you see it, right? Mm-hmm. Michael says, the first time I heard about replacement theory was from Jesse Jackson when he was leading a demonstration where he led the chant, hey, ho, hey, 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 ho, ho, white culture has got to go. I was wondering if they wanted to replace Shakespeare and Hemingway with Public Enemy Number One and NWA. Michael, that's a racist comment. And here's the thing about that, Michael. When he says white culture's got to go, he's not saying white people have got to go. He's referring to a culture of violence emanating from white people toward black people. That's what he means.
And I'll be
that should be obvious.
And I'll be honest with you. Public Enemy, if he wants to go there, Public Enemy would be a great course to study. They're brilliant in their words. Chuck
D. But we're not replacing
anything.
There's no there's no fear that you should have right. that Shakespeare right. is getting kicked out for NWA.
And if he understands NWA was a reflection of what was happening in Compton during that time in L.A. at the time. It's a reflection. Like you don't have, you would never, I think Icy said this best, you wouldn't have a horror film without murder. Or death. So you can't talk about issues in L.A. the way the NWA did without talking about police brutality and the issues within the community. So you're right. You're going to hear those people who are going to make those convenient excuses and comparisons for shock value. And if your starting point is to listen to them, you have a long way to go. If your starting point is to dismiss them and to create a counter-narrative, then you're doing the right work.
Dr. Nelms, I love you. Thank you for being here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That's Dr. Sean Nelms. One of the leaders of this community, a Buffalo native. I hope it's moved you this hour. I hope it's changed you maybe a little bit. From the whole team at Connections, we love all of our listeners. We appreciate you listening. And let's keep on working on this together. We'll be back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.